Backseat Producers, episode 232, Fahrenheit 451. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Jill.
And we are the Backseat Producers. Welcome. It's good seeing you, Jill. It's been a little while.
Thanks, yeah. Glad to be back.
So, we're still without Adam. He won't be with us for...
a little while. Longer.
Month and a half, I think, still.
Still doing the school thing.
Yeah.
I think he's secretly watching all of the John Cusack movies in chronological order twice. And
yeah,
he just doesn't want to tell us that.
I don't know what happened, but somehow I got... I think he must have possessed me at some point, because I just watched a Nick Cage movie, and now I'm like three quarters of the way through another one. So, have you seen or heard of Drive Angry?
No.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
No, I have heard
of
it.
Oh my god. This movie is Ghost Rider if Ghost Rider didn't take itself seriously.
Well, have you seen, we watched Studio 60 on Sunset Strip. It's an old Aaron Sorkin series.
Oh, yeah.
And in it, one of the characters does Nick Cage throughout the whole show. Mm-hmm. And so every time I see it, I immediately think about him.
Yeah.
And chuckle.
So then I'm watching Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. Have you seen that one?
No.
That one's actually kind of... it's not bad, because the character, like, the first thing the character does, like, the first scene of the movie, it's, like, in the aftermath of Katrina.
Okay.
All right? And, like, there's this, you see this snake swimming around in this water, and then you realize the snake is in a prison, or at least a jail area, and there's a guy in a cell, and the snake is, like, coming up toward the guy. And the layout of the place is really weird. There's like prison cell, and then there's a walkway up. So there's a high ground to this area, and he is in the cell, and the water's rising. So through the door comes Val Kilmer and Nick Cage.
What year is this movie?
This movie was made like 2 years ago.
So
if that
old Val Kilmer and old Nick Cage.
Yeah, this is old Val Kilmer, but he's not as puffy as he's been.
He's not as bloated.
Yeah, I mean he's filled out, but he's not the bloated Val Kilmer like the Jabba. But so they're talking, and Nick Cage is like, "I'm not going to save you. They make a bet about how soon the guy's going to die from the rising water. Like, let's just leave. We'll get the time of death from the coroner." So Nick Cage is like, "No." And he takes off his coat and shirt and jumps into the water. Next thing you see is him at a doctor, and he's being examined, and his back is all screwed up, I guess, from jumping
into the water.
So he's popping pain pills. So through the whole movie, he's like snorting Oxycontin and just taking as much. And he's moving like this because he can't move his back. So, you know, he can't move his neck, so all of his movements are from his shoulder. It's really weird and quirky, and he's fried out of his mind most of the movie because he's snorting Oxy. And,
is the plot
perfect.
Decent?
It's not bad.
It's a ringing endorsement.
It's weird because it's so quirky. Like, the character is so bizarre that it's Nick Cage playing Nick Cage, but it makes sense because he's on Oxy and he can't move his neck.
And it's Nick Cage.
Yeah. And he's like, every time he goes up to somebody, he's pointing a gun in somebody's face. He's like, "You need to do this for me now." And they're like, what? He's like, "I'm going to shoot you in the face." Okay.
We'll have to save that one for when Adam comes back.
I am actually enjoying it. It's like this really. At first, it was weird because it was like the message that I got from the first 45 minutes of the movie is, "Hey, if you start doing drugs, taking painkillers on your day job, you will be a better cop." Because he was
only
one of the
in
best,
New Orleans.
He was one of the best cops, like doing the job, and he was whacked out of his mind the whole time.
Says a lot.
Yeah. So, ringing endorsement. Drive Angry though, it's that movie is ridiculous and terrible and violent.
But so bad, it's actually good.
It's actually good. Yeah, it's actually really good. At one point, he's like, I am going to drink beer out of that guy's skull. And then by the end of the movie, he does. He is drinking beer out of the skull bone of this guy. It's that ridiculous. Yeah, I don't know where to go from there. It's hard to transition from that.
Well, it's the kind of movie that gets made when people stop reading books.
That's true.
So it's a good segue to Fahrenheit 451.
The crazy thing is it? I want to say The Bad Lieutenant might be based on a book.
It probably could be.
It very well could be. It very well could be because of how convoluted it gets toward the end. I can see it being from a cheap summer pulp kind of novel. He's making deals with drug dealers to pay off his bookie, and then because he can't get the drug dealers to work quick enough, he finds some guy who is who plays college football, and he threatens him because he finds pot on him, and he threatens him that if he doesn't shave points, if he doesn't shave points off the game, he's going to arrest him and ruin his football career. I mean, it's just ridiculous how convoluted it gets, but it's actually kind of amusing.
Is it on Netflix?
I don't know what I'm watching. I recorded it off of Stars or Encore, so it might be on Netflix. I think it's that level of film that it's probably on Netflix
or Hulu or iTunes or something.
Yeah, something.
You'll find it. Just look.
So
the dollar bin at Walmart.
Yeah, the dollar bin at Walmart.
So
your local grocery store.
This episode will be released. So this episode is going to be released on the 18th of June. By the time we record again, we'll be just like right at the cusp of the beginning of summer, and so the start of summer for kicking off summer, we're going to do some summer themed movies. And we're going to actually start it off with Dog Day Afternoon, which is available on Netflix, by the way. I think that's the only real business I've got. We might have a special episode here or there in the next couple of weeks. We may have a week or two off with summer vacations and such. So just fair warning, don't be surprised if the schedule gets a little erratic. We won't be taking another 6-month hiatus. It's just a week or two off. Last week, on Wednesday, Ray Bradbury died. We didn't have anything scheduled for this week, and I kind of thought we should do something to honor his passing. And as much as I've complained about the movie The Sound of Thunder, I didn't feel that would have been an appropriate movie to do, because apparently I haven't read his short story, Sound of Thunder, but the movie was terrible. And I might actually record something for Backseat Quickies on that, because that movie is that it's worth talking about, but not for more than about 10 minutes. So I made the executive decision that we were going to talk about Fahrenheit 451. So, what do you guys think?
I haven't watched this movie for a long time, but I'm fond of rewatching it again. I've just realized how kind of dated it was. It's still not bad. It's got some problems, but it's at least a decent interpretation of 451.
Yeah, I thought it had some good elements. I was surprised at how prophetic some of the stuff was, particularly now, even in terms of language.
Yeah,
that struck me, you know, after a number of things. But didn't when I first watched.
There was some, yes, I immediately noticed there were some a few things in there that unfortunately have already come true.
Yes,
and it happens right in our living room every afternoon.
Yeah.
Well, even the language, some of the things that they use, like the term cells, you know, I thought was kind of interesting, you know, and the whole concept of antisocial was fascinating, too. So I liked it. I liked it for that reason. There were parts of it, though, that it was just like, oh, God, can this be over? Because it is a little dated. It's got an unusual flow to it.
And there's a couple of technical reasons why the flow of the movie, or at least the way that it is assembled,
you know, and I thought some of the dialogue, and I don't know if it was because it was his first English speaking movie, but some of the dialogue was unusual and kind of stunted. So that was
on purpose. This was the problem between the lead actor Oscar Werner and Truffaut. About how to interpret his performance that actually almost came to blows on the set.
It should have, because he was Montag was the one that really he drove me crazy.
Yeah,
you know,
and that was the big falling out between Oscar and Francois is that one of the in the trivia parts of it their big argument was that Truffaut wanted him to give a more lively and personable performance.
Yeah, more human.
And he said, no, this is a science fiction movie. I need to do a more stilted and robotic-like, which is a rather strange interpretation. But
well, and actually it goes against the development of the character and the change of the character after he reads David Copperfield. I can see it at the beginning.
Right.
But not after he discovers ideas and books. Mm-hmm. You know, and decides to become his own hero.
Well, he started questioning and thinking about the way things were.
Yeah.
Which he had never really done before.
Yeah. So, I liked the movie. I remembered liking the movie. I enjoyed watching it this time. There were things that I was questioning, but they actually put together pretty well. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And I'm going to play the role of Adam here for a minute and say that there's a big part of Montag's character that I think could definitely be referencing the experiences and like the concept of like the 7-year itch of a marriage because of how he reacts to his wife versus
Laura. No, Laura was his wife. Linda was his wife. And
the girl.
Yeah, that's the other Julie Christie.
The other girl, yeah. So
I read it down.
I'll get into the details of that one later. But yeah,
Chris,
I enjoyed it, but some of the performances weren't great. Some of them were very robotic on purpose. Some of them, like Montag's character, yeah, you're right. Can totally see it if that's how he was in the beginning and then he kind of loosened up at the end. That would have been a cool way for him to play that character. But that's not how it went down.
Now, I thought Julie Christie was pretty good, though. I enjoyed her.
Yeah.
And the fact that she had to play two characters I thought was good. And I did like the contrast between the real world society and the kind of robotic loss of all identity and the transition to, you know, more of a natural state with the book people. They felt genuine. They had personality.
Yeah.
So I can see that contrast and to bring out more of why we want the alternative to the society. And I like that. And I actually thought, where it kind of like hit me was my son Joffrey was looking over my shoulder as I was reading this or watching this movie on an iPad, and he got scared and left. All right, now this is a kid who has seen, you know, all the Harry Potters, all the Lord of the Rings, and it was the soundtrack.
Yeah.
And I think the soundtrack really kind of drew you in, and it was almost like another character in the movie. And I was not surprised to hear that it was Hitchcock's main sound man. And
Holden reacts viscerally to the soundtrack. We were watching the movie Coraline in the theater. The music in that is very evocative, and like we almost had to leave.
Yeah,
nothing was happening on the screen. Like the characters were walking through.
He won't watch it.
The characters were walking through, but the music swelled and got real dark, and it was like he grabbed my arm and he said, "I'm ready to go.
Yeah, I'm done.
I want to leave." And I made him stay.
And he had that reaction with this movie, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, and it definitely had a buildup. I mean, it definitely added a whole other element to the enjoyability of the movie. You know, I thought visually, I thought it was interesting too. Like, I love the opening montage where it's just images and the written word, and there is no, or it's not the spoken
narration,
word,
yeah,
and not the written word. And then how they bring back that concept of the antennas later, where the woman's talking to Montag about, well, you know, they were different, you know, notice their houses. And
yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. You know, and now every day, today, everybody's got a, you know, dish on their roof.
Right. So from the beginning, this movie set itself apart, and I loved the opening credits.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved that it's all spoken.
Yeah.
There's no words on the screen. That was really cool to me.
Yeah, and that theme plays out pretty much throughout the movie. There's a point, I don't know if people pick this up, but when Montag picks up his newspaper, it's all comics.
Cartoons. Yeah.
It's all comics.
But without words.
Without words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all graphic.
Because I actually thought when he reached down and picked it up, I was like, no, no, why does he have a newspaper? And then they showed him reading it, and they very clearly pointed out that it was all
comics.
It was all sequential art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I liked too, and there are a couple of times that Truffaut did it that were like almost over the top, kind of hammer the audience with it. But the egocentric, narcissistic element when you take books and ideas out of it was fascinating. Whether it was the Linda watching that TV show that she was participating in, or that really weird scene where Montag is back on the tram and everybody's like touching themselves, they're going around on their lips, that one woman caressing the fur stole. I mean, it was like, where'd this come from? But it, you know, but again, it goes back to that narcissism. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, I had a different interpretation of that. I thought that was essentially meaning that these people are so starved for any sort of contact that they were willing just to get it themselves. I mean, it was just a not so much a trend, it was a reaction to the society just being so alienated and cold that they needed some sort of self-affirmation, even if just if they're touching their own skin.
What I thought was really interesting, and I meant to pay more attention to see if they did it throughout, and I may have just gotten used to it, but the opening scene when he and his boss are talking when they're on the truck, there are no personal pronouns used.
No, yeah.
And I thought that was really cool. That was like a really cool way to use the language to evoke that.
Well, the captain mentions this during one of his little rant. And the only way to make society work is to make everybody, well, only way to make everybody happy in society was to make everyone equal.
Yes, that was phenomenal.
Flatten everything. I mean, okay, everybody's equal, but that's just it.
But that was a phenomenal, I don't know if you call it soliloquy in film or not.
Rant
that
or whatever.
Whole thing was really well done. And there's been a lot of books about this kind of concept of utopia, making everything the same, in which, you know, at the end, it isn't equal, it isn't happy, it doesn't work. You know, but the narcissism I sort of picked up, like where Linda had her friends over, and one of the women was talking about how having babies would be nice, they'd look just like you, wouldn't that be so nice?
Yeah,
you know, and so it was pretty driven on their own needs, and it was, a lot of it was just programming, and sad thing is it's happening now.
Well, that's just it. I mean, she was watching the television there, I say, oh God, that's Oprah 1966. Yeah, it's Cousins talks just exactly like our modern day afternoon talk show host.
Well,
I could have dropped Dr. Phil or Oprah or Ellen DeGeneres right in there.
Any reality TV show where you get to vote, you get to participate, you get to choose.
You're part of the show.
Yeah. You know, but I love Linda. Montag. Yeah. I love
what
the fact
do you think,
that
Linda.
That's the correct response.
And the first time, she doesn't even get it out.
No, I
she's,
know. It's
she's
awful.
So paralyzed and frozen. She's like,
yes, because he's thinking, like, she's
perfect choice. What? I kind of like Montag's response, and he's like, is this really happening?
Well, and I love the fact that he's like, don't you think maybe the cousins called every Linda?
All 200,000 other Lindas? And she says, well, yeah, but you didn't have to tell me that.
Yeah, why did you burst my bubble?
Well, burst my bubble. I was perfectly happy there.
But he had that great rant, too, about how you're all just a bunch of zombies, you know, not living, just wasting time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now that whole scene there, something went wrong with that, because I suddenly Montag is like super... super intellectual, all in just one jump.
Well, but
he has
red.
Whole,
yeah.
Well, he's, because he has red.
He has red, but you know, the thing is, it just seems inappropriate. And then he walks in and just slams them like
well,
that.
And
then, he does that really stupid thing where he says, and you need to leave because I'm going to go read.
Well, but except for, I mean, there's the symbolism of David Copperfield, though. The idea of being born, and I think that's supposed to be kind of this rebirth, this rediscovery, and he's going to be, you know, the hero in his own life. And, you know, so I think that that's kind of his enthusiasm. But it was so stilted that I think the acting took away from that rebirth.
The emotion
for the
of that moment. It just seemed...
The women acted far better.
Better, yes. Their reaction was great.
Yeah. Well, for the characters that
they were.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, yes, when he starts reading that poem and one of them has almost a nervous breakdown of real emotion, it was very strange, but it worked. Because
she even says something like, I remember feeling these things again.
Right, yeah.
I don't like it.
Yeah. I'm actually having emotions. Oh, this is terrible. My worldview is no longer nice and safe. It's suddenly
books
ugly.
Make people unhappy because they read about other things and they realize that they're comparing their lives to these other things and it's not real.
Oh my God! And they're actually having independent thought. Oh
well,
my brain hurts.
And the idea of conflict that you can have two different opinions and that's bad. And then I loved his other one where. You know, he talked about how egocentric all of the writers were, particularly poets.
Oh, in biography.
Yes, the memoirs. Ah. That was great. I did really enjoy the scene with the old woman lighting, and I liked how, and some of it was campy and dated. But I did like how he tried to make the books seem alive. Yeah. When they were burning, and I thought that was particularly for the time period was a really interesting way to shoot that scene.
Mm-hmm. Right, in her own last act of total defiance, here has anybody got a light? She pulls out the matches and says, "Well, fuck you!" And like,
yeah, that was really cool because they weren't expecting that,
right?
No, and they didn't know what to do.
No. No.
Yes, they never had any... Like, the whole thing is they keep asking somebody get her out of here. Like, nobody reacts because they've never had anybody actually resist. So they don't know how to deal with that kind of emotion.
Yeah, so the firemen were really inefficient.
Well, yeah, but...
The first thing they do, so they go to that house and they bag up all the books. Then they just toss the bag out. Then they have to pick all the books up to put them on the grill... to burn them.
Well, it's a problem of a socialist society. It's a make-work program.
You have to follow the rules.
You have to follow the rules, no matter how foolish they are.
And the superior officer kind of was really big on that. I mean, even yelling at the guy with the unbuttoned shirt. And although I did find him to be kind of an interesting character in terms of, like, the idea of the likeness and the fact that he kept wanting to give those pins away. It was kind of like, all right, you want to be an individual, but nobody else is allowed to be, and so I thought that was interesting. I like the Hope Book people, although it got me thinking, and if I had mentioned this to Jeff, it's like, okay, well, what book would you pick?
Yeah.
What pick would you be?
Yeah, and that's really
that's a good,
hard.
That's a good question.
I mean, I'm kind of going, okay, well, you know, looking back, you know, I read The Little Prince both in French and in English, so that one, and it's short, so I can memorize it. Something like that one, but there's so many other good books, and Jeff's like, well, I think I'll do an anthology of, you know, The Complete Works of Shakespeare. I'm like, yeah, of course you would. you know, but what book would you pick?
Mm. Well, not much would you pick. What book would you be?
Well, it's it. Yeah.
To yeah, you would be the book.
You would be the book.
Because you are the book at that point.
Is it that?
That's a great question. I have a book that is my favorite book. And I think I would probably go with that. And it's The Stone and the Flute by Hans Behmen.
I haven't read it.
It's a German author. And his works are in German. A few of them have been translated to English. This is one of the few. This book is like, it's a tome.
Yeah.
But it tells a story in the way I like story. I like stories within stories. So the main character, he's born of a Viking culture. So their names are all representative of who they are. And
yeah, their clans.
Well, and like his father was Great Roarer. So he was loud and boisterous and huge, and even as an infant, the main character was silent. And Great Roarer was like, "Oh, there's something wrong with him. He's not roaring. He's not doing it." And his mother said, "No, he's listening. He's listening." And so the main character's name is Listener. And then the story jumps till he's like in his early 20s, and he's just this guy who ends up leaving the Vikings and going to discover his place in the world and going to all these different villages and clans. And it's kind of it is a fantasy, like a low fantasy world. So there is some magic to it. And like the people are all representative of like who they are. Like there's the carp people and they're like this little fishing village, but the people all kind of look like fish. But when he goes to the town, they tell him a story. And then he travels on to the next town, and he gets a new story.
Like
a
Canterbury Tales.
Except what's cool is like if he actually would pay attention to the stories that he's just randomly picking up, the next place he goes, if he were to just apply what they told him in that last story, his life would be perfect. But he continues to make mistake after mistake after mistake. To at one point, he ends up being like a judge over this small kingdom, and he finds that this guy supposedly had stolen some things, and he didn't look into it, but as the judge, he's just like, cut out his tongue. So the guy gets his tongue cut out. Turns out the guy was not in the wrong.
Oh, no.
And he finds out, and so now he has been sentenced to serve that guy. So he has to serve him until the time that guy deems necessary for him to be released. And it is kind of a rambly kind of story in the way it's told with story after story after story. At one point, he gets turned to stone and is just there for years as a stone statue. He is completely aware of everything that goes on around him, but he can't do anything. And it's got a lot of really cool symbolism for like the path that a man takes in his life and how he goes through, you know, learning to be a man, you know,
it's like
to,
a hero's
to be
journey,
macho. It's kind of a hero's journey, but it's not an adventure story. There's some little adventures to it, but he's not going to go off and fight a dragon. He's not doing anything heroic. Right.
Yeah.
But it's like his own personal hero's journey. So it's like he learns how to be a man, and then he learns the mistakes that he's made being a man. And then he's got to be humble, and he's got to learn how to be humble, and he's got to learn how to be judicious, and every step along the way, he keeps making the same mistakes over and over and over again. But it's cool because it
sounds. I mean, well, it actually sounds realistic too.
That's what really touched me when I first read it. It was like, man, this guy is real.
Yeah,
you know, he's a real character in this world. That's a fantasy world, and he's the hero of the story that's not a very heroic story. And he's made mistakes, and he has to pay for them. And I don't know. It's just, it really spoke to me. I think I would pick that book.
Yeah, long story short. I was toying with The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison for similar reasons. I mean, yeah. I didn't have the same life, but I could really relate to aspects of the main characters wanting to be blonde and blue-eyed and this kind of ideal. And, it's a tough thing, because you also look at it in terms of, what book would I preserve for others, or which one do I most identify that I would want to be? Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting thing for me is just kind of, and I still haven't come to a resolution on it, but to kind of think about that.
Yeah.
Even looking at the books they chose.
Yeah. Yeah. I think either that or something fun. Something like The Hobbit.
Yeah. Well, that's, there's no way it'd be Pride and Prejudice,
Some of these,
I just assume never read it. It will never be Great Expectations, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
I might even burn that one now. but how about you?
I made a really hard choice there. I'd almost have to table that for a while and think about it because there's so many out there I really like. But to memorize them and commit them to memory, that's a different thing altogether.
Well, and then not only the thing I like about it too is not only commit it to memory for you, but realizing at some point you have to be responsible for passing it on.
Yeah.
And teaching it to somebody else, teaching the nuance. So I like that scene.
Word for word, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. I thought the choices of some of the books they burned were interesting. In fact, I'd like to go back and kind of look at them because they had people like Genet, who was a famous kind of out there gay writer, French gay writer. Mm. And so there was... Some of the choices were very purposeful for the books that he burned. And I'd love to kind of sit down and kind of look at the list. The Genet one really kind of flew at me. I mean, one minute I saw it, I was like, oh, he's also talking about identity. Mm-hmm. People who are outliers,
Yeah. I like how one of the books was Martian Chronicles.
Yeah.
That was cool. I thought that was nice.
It was the young boy who comes up and said, I'm the Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, I thought that was
cool.
And
that's interesting how they all identify themselves by the title of the book. I am that. I am not, Joe Sixpack. I am the Martian Chronicles. I am David Copperfield. Yep. They're not just, they are totally into this now.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, how many of us would actually commit the time and effort to actually memorize word for word an entire book, especially a long one?
Oh, I it would be very difficult for me. My brain doesn't work that way. It would be a real struggle.
And if I could set it to music, I another probably question could do
too,
it.
Is the people who would memorize these books are going to memorize the books that either influence them very heavily or they really like. What about all the others that aren't as popular?
Yeah, well, they disappear. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
The thing is that there'd be this tremendous loss or narrowing of the human knowledge because you're only going to be able to...
I think that's kind of an interesting statement, though, too, in that...
Really?
In that even if there's not an active destruction of culture, there's a passive destruction of culture in that... If things are lost, they're lost. That's it. It's gone.
If there's not a popularity option, and they just are not reproduced anymore, it becomes a dead end line.
Or banned. I mean, we just lost Maurice Sendak not too long ago, and you think about the volume of his books that have been banned in libraries for not being child appropriate. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of kids who have never read any of his books. And so we deal with it now as a culture. We've got kids who don't read, so who aren't going to experience books.
Well, and we now also have the editing of classic books to make them appropriate.
Yes. How many controversies about Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer have still gone on, even though Mark Twain said these are not children's books. I never wrote them for that way.
Well, but we have it. We have censoring now in terms of. Just history. You look at textbooks and science. And
well, that is a whole thing in itself. How to culturally cleanse all our textbooks.
Well, they even showed that in the movie.
Yeah,
with Montauk, with the death of Montauk. Yeah. It was like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and I was even thinking of things like how our news is the choices in terms of what we are
presented,
are,
yes.
are asked to watch, whether and it's things like you know, you look at just ridiculous car chases like the O.J. Simpson car chase. Mm-hmm. When we have like wars and we have you know, ethnic cleansing happen at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, but this is what they choose to put mm-hmm. on. We have all of, now that we have an election, we have all this backbiting and morality about, you know, all these political issues, but yet we have a war. We have probably the highest suicide rate among veterans coming back.
Yeah.
And nobody cares about that stuff.
Well, they don't want to talk about that.
Well, no, and they don't, and they're choosing not to show it. Yeah. So we can't even really, you know.
No, because we're leading with the Sandusky trial.
Yeah. Well, or Mark McGuire. I mean, I try not to go blue, but like, why the hell does Congress care about who takes steroids? Who really gives a rat's ass whether or not Mark McGuire took steroids?
Well, because it's not fair.
You know, but yet they can't seem to fix the educational.
I
mean, you start
they
looking
seem
at all these things.
A budget,
that are true, you know, things that are important for nobody cares.
No.
They could put an asterisk next to his name.
Why is it important for them to do that? Somebody,
right, that's a commissioner
somebody
of baseball's
should.
Job, not
yeah,
theirs.
Somebody well, should, but it shouldn't be a public forum.
I mean, really, do we care? We're paying these people millions and millions of dollars. We go and pay our $11 for a beer. Is it our own fault?
Yeah.
You know?
Some time back, there was an interesting TED Talk about the same phenomenon. If you take the moment, a few minutes to look it up. Yes. The presenter who was talking about how we essentially self-censor ourselves through our internet searches to the point where we now have shaped our world into it only presents us the stuff we want to hear about, but we miss that random thing out there that could be interesting, but we're never going to see it because we've all shaped our worldview.
Well,
only to the little things that we like.
Yeah, we're becoming antisocial, just like he talks about.
And our social networks are doing it for us.
Yep. Yeah, Facebook.
Julie lost the stone in her wedding ring. So for 2 months after that, every ad I had on Facebook was for diamond distributors. Because we had searched to how to find a replacement stone. We're planning a vacation. We're planning to go to Vegas on vacation. Today in Facebook, I saw ads 3 different times. I opened Facebook and looked, and there were ads for the Bellagio. just because of searches we had done, not on Facebook.
Yeah. I mean,
it's shaping things for us. When I open Amazon now, it presents me things based on what I have looked at
purchases.
Before, not what I'm looking,
well,
not what I want to look for.
Simpler.
But it's all it's doing is it's representing things I have looked at. It's not even assuming that hey, you looked at this before, you might be interested in this. It's you looked at this, but you didn't buy it.
Yeah.
Here it is again, right here. Are you sure you don't want it?
Yeah. You know, and it's that. I mean, particularly when you look at when this was written. And you kind of look at how we've kind of fallen into it. It's it's horrible.
Well,
it really is.
It's sort of disturbing when you sit down and really think about some of the aspects of what they're showing versus what is happening. And unless you live through that period, you're not going to see it because you never had any point of comparison previously.
Yeah.
And there again, we're shaping we're creating our future by destroying our past.
Yeah, well, and like even like the death of Montauk, all I can think of was weapons of mass destruction and going to war over something that didn't exist, but they said it was, you know, and it was just, yeah, like, oh my God, yeah.
Yeah.
When are we ever going to learn? But we don't care. We like
it's
our
what's,
TV.
It's what's
we
presented
like,
to us.
We like having our input on TV. We have control, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
As well as
what do you think, Linda?
That's the right decision.
Yeah, I mean, so that kind of aspect of it I found fascinating, you know. And I think there's a lot in the movie you can kind of go back and kind of go, oh, wow, that was kind of cool. Or, you know, Truffaut's decision in this was really interesting. So you kind of can overlook some of the acting issues.
Well, yeah, as long as you can sit back and have that now point of comparison. But me, you, and Tony, I still had the period of the 1960s and 70s recently still in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say we show this to Holden 10 years from now. Will he pick up on some of that stuff from that point?
I don't...
Because he's in a world that never... Well, he's coming from a world that never had a disconnected past.
Right.
I mean, there's never been a time in his life when there wasn't an internet, there wasn't a cell phone, there wasn't a flat-screen TV or reality shows.
Daddy, is it true that there used to be firemen that put out fires?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the point you get to. But I think there's always the aspect of a nanny society that is going to try to protect you from yourself. And that's part of the danger of the world of Fahrenheit 451 is that, you know, you don't need to be unhappy. And what makes people unhappy is free thought. And so the way to get people away from free thought is to take away books, to take away something that sparks creativity and imagination. When we can just pretend, right?
I mean, it challenges you. It makes you uncomfortable.
Here, don't read that book. Just watch the audio video presentation.
And they get rid of discomfort through the medication.
Yep.
You know, and we didn't even talk about the pills that they were popping the whole time. What is she taking? It's a red one.
Well, that's just it.
Red number two.
There was no names on the bottles.
There's no written word.
No, it's just number.
Yeah. Right.
It was just, yeah, it's the purple number eights. Yeah. And like, yeah, there was no labels on the bottles. He doesn't even know what they're taking.
Oh, yeah, we see these all the time.
Oh, yeah.
We'll just replace
her blood.
Well, and then, you know, you overdose.
Yeah, we do 50 of these a day.
And your wife is horny afterwards.
Yes. Oh, she's gonna have some very strong appetites.
Yeah.
I loved how creepy that guy was about it. And Montag's like, what are you talking about? I have no clue what you're referencing here.
Yeah, I mean, it was... Well, and I loved, like, the hook of the leg and how she gets him into bed.
Yeah.
It's like, what was that?
It was... No, it was the self-defense video she was watching earlier in the show. She used the self-defense move. Yeah, it was... That was good. That was actually really good. But I think, I think you know, in terms of what Holden's going to... See, I mean, we always heard about book burnings and the banning of books and stuff like that in libraries, but it never, for me, it was never, that was never a real thing.
Right. You know, it was something that happened to other people.
Right. Now, for me, you know, in the late 80s and what I connected with in that is like the PMRC and the censorship of books, or not books, music.
Yeah.
The you know, censoring music, putting labels on music, and that we're seeing
explicit
the same things
on this YouTube video.
Yeah. Yeah. And now we're seeing, you know, the censorship of public videos, the things like YouTube. If you search a site other than YouTube, yeah, you can see things that are just off of... You know, you can see people being killed. You can see dead bodies. You can see nudity. You can see sex, violence, everything else. But if you go to the big public forum like YouTube, we have to keep that sanitized because we advertise there. And the advertisers won't like it if it's not sanitized. But we can show...
You gotta keep the advertisers happy.
But we can show a dude who turns his dead cat into a helicopter...
And fly it around.
Flies it around the backyard. And that's perfectly acceptable. And that is
because
really
we know
creepy.
Not real.
Well, is it? You know?
Isn't it?
Yeah. So it's... I think there's... It's going to be different. It's not going to be the same. It's not going to be... There's not going to be a direct connection to book burning in quite the same way.
Right.
Because quite frankly, the technology is there that you don't even know what people are reading.
Well, here's the other creepy
thing.
But
the nice thing, though, sorry, go ahead.
A little creepy thing. Remember just a few years back, Amazon, when they brought out the e-reader,
mm-hmm.
There was a series of books that were put out there. And in a copyright dispute, Amazon recalled them. And they mm-hmm. didn't tell anybody they were recalling them. Yeah. They just disappeared off your reader.
Right.
I mean, that's a nice, interesting little interesting censorship right there. When you think about it, that you know, you, even though we say, okay, we got all these ebooks stored on there, you don't own them. You're just renting them. As long as you have that reader. And they, the content creator can do anything with them he wants.
By the same
including
token.
Recalling them.
Right. By the same token, the alternate to that is that I can hold my e-reader up and be reading anything. Sitting at work. Sitting at the lunch table at work. I could be reading anything. And nobody knows unless they're seeing what's on my page. Apparently, from what I heard in attending some panels at Archon and things like that, that the e-readers actually created a spike in readership of among males who enjoy romance novels. Because there are men that
right,
enjoy reading romance novels, but they can't read them.
But you can't get 50 Shades of Grey in every single public library.
No.
I mean, because it's considered offensive. You know, but what we do have also that, that opens up doors in terms of freedom is things like Twitter and blogs. Mm-hmm. I think blogs really open up, and it's not just for materials considered offensive, but for actual news, for, you know,
all the
good dialogue. Yeah, well, that's it. And active dialogue as opposed to, you know, things that are essentially, I mean, to boil it down, written by rich white men, you know, that run a lot of the news organizations, they run all the magazines, you know, so you can actually find, I think, a more open voice through the blogs than you can, you know, anywhere else.
As long as the ISP or is not blocking you or...
Well, and as long as the blogger has some measure of journalistic integrity.
Well, yes, but then you get to choose.
Then you get to the problems where you'll have, and I haven't seen it too much in the last couple of months, but for a while there, about a year ago, I was seeing it about every month or two, a story would pop. And it was such and such state is proposing legislature to ban something. Generally, it was gay marriage or that homosexuals can't adopt or things like that. And there would be this violent fervor of an uproar until somebody noticed that, hey, if you follow the links back to this article is 7 years old. There was a path of 20 to 30 people before it got to you that you could see no one checked.
Not checking the dirty little secret of journalism.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the danger to it also is that it is open, and it's open.
Yeah,
and so you have to question even
the
open content.
Yeah, but I think you should question it, you know, regardless.
Right,
I think that's a good
right,
skill
and
too.
That's and see, and I think the danger there was. People were given what they thought was open content that had been thought checked, and it hadn't been, and they didn't bother to think check it themselves, and I think that's an interesting.
But at some point,
what do you trust?
Well, you shouldn't. You should multiple sources. I mean,
yeah.
You know, everybody thought Al Gore won the election, you know, and that was major news channels, and he didn't, and. You know, so you have to kind of question, and I think that that's part of the beauty of having literature and having sources of writing is that it forces you to, well, I shouldn't say forces you, it provides you the opportunity to think critically and to actually come up with your own conclusion as opposed to just passively absorbing whatever news source you're getting your information from. And, you know, and I think that our mainstream is they don't want to do it anymore. They want to be spoon-fed. They want to eat their pills and watch their...
Thinking hurts.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable and it takes too much time.
You know.
I'm a very busy person.
Give me the headlines.
Give me the world in 30 seconds.
And I've noticed a really bad trend recently in big media and blogs is to bury the story behind a headline. And it's, I mean, it's getting bad. It's like flat out the headline is exactly opposite of what the text is.
Well, yeah, it's become about advertising and getting that shock, that attention.
Eyeballs. I need eyeballs. Mm-hmm.
You know, well, and I don't like
click that link.
The knee-jerk reaction to, like I'm thinking of the girl who, the teenager that was touted as, you know, being launched a celebrity status for starting a petition to get 17 Magazine not to publish, or to she wanted them to publish one issue that wasn't photoshopped. My thing is, don't buy the damn magazine if it doesn't represent who you are.
Yeah.
You're giving them the money. You're a consumer. If you want that, go and be a producer. Well, that's it. Be a producer.
Yeah. Make a magazine.
Do what you want to do. You know? And don't buy that crap.
The thing is, the technology is available for anyone.
Yeah.
Anyone to make their own magazine.
And we don't need the legal system to change that stuff.
No.
We don't need petitions. We don't need, God knows, we don't need Congress sitting and, you know, toiling over whether or not, you know, we should sanction these people.
Not when there's real problems.
Writing a letter to the editor saying, I'm tired of your photoshopped crap. Either change this or you have a few less subscribers.
Well, that's it. Don't buy the magazine.
You're on notice. I am not buying your magazine until I see on the newsstands that it is not photoshopped.
Yeah, which it's never going to happen because nope. Everybody wants to look like that. You know, and, you know, I get it,
happy.
But I don't buy it. Well, that's it. I want it to be easy, you know.
It's funny. I was watching a video earlier today of bad photoshops, and it's almost fun to get the bad ones because there are some really bad ones. So I saw one that was someone was running on a beach. It looked like they were running on a beach, but and just the way they were posed, but you could clearly see this person was by themselves, except there was a hand on their shoulder. It was the weirdest, like somebody had their arm around the person.
Was it Michael Caine?
No.
Yeah. In the hand?
Yeah. I think the only other thing, and this has really nothing to do about anything. Julie, my wife is named after Julie Christine.
From Dr. Zhivago? Is that the movie, or?
I don't know.
She was amazing in that, too.
I don't know. When was Dr. Zhivago?
I don't have to look it up.
Late 60s.
Yeah. It might have been.
I bet it was before 66, though, don't you think? It was before this movie.
That might have been it. I think I've hit on everything I wanted to talk about with the movie. Was it now, Jill? You said you reread it this week.
Yeah, mainly because I was trying to figure out why they had Clarice take on the role she did in the book. She dies. She gets hit by a car. She dies, and then he took out all the speeding car element of it, and it's his mentor is a man. You know, so I don't know if it was some sort of deal where, you know, Julie Christie was going to be the thing that everybody wanted to go see, and so she had to play two parts, but she dies. She gets killed.
Either that or they just want to make that, show that connection between what he had and what he wanted.
I mean, to draw it, make it even more obvious?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be.
Just to really hammer that home, I think was.
But it was. Yeah, no, I'm glad I went back and read it, because those kind of pieces and that character was kind of a neat character as a professor and kind of filled in a lot, but I don't think it hurt the movie necessarily. I just thought it was an interesting choice.
Were there any other major changes to the
story? That was the big one for me in terms of just the character development. And also, I liked, because Montag's character is impacted when Clarice is killed, more so than I thought he was at the end of this movie. He almost got off a little too easy emotionally, but no, that was the big one for me.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, there's some minor stuff, like some character development in terms of the firehouse and such, but nothing that would have impacted the movie enough.
Yeah, so that was the one thing that did bug me about initially in the movie. So he's talking to this girl on the train, and she is flat out flirting with him, and he's like, yeah, he's kind of playing it cool.
Well, he's a fireman.
Well, yeah, and and then it's like they're halfway through their, I mean, probably three quarters through what I would have considered the conversation. And he's like, yeah, and he says something about my wife, and it was like, whoa. This is a weird conversation, and this is a weird point in the conversation for you to finally tell her or to mention the fact that you're married.
Is it, though?
Unless he was just that clueless.
Man?
I don't know. I don't know if he was just that clueless that he was that she was hitting on him.
I think he was. I mean, you got to remember, this is a society that's been pretty emotionally...
Well, that's true.
Emotionally stunted. So we don't know how his previous relationship with Linda got started. I mean, whether it was just an arranged thing or just happened to drift together, or they decided to live together and get married because that's what society demands of them.
And see, and that was what was weird. There seemed to be no reason in that society to have a marital structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, because they had no other structure anyway. Like, even like the house, it was his name and a number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he didn't even have last names.
Oh, yeah.
Montag.
Yeah, well, I think... Is that his last name or his first name? In the book, I know it's his last name. It's Guy Montag.
Yeah.
In the book.
Right.
But they just refer to each other by their surnames all the time. And we don't really hear other than Christine and Linda, because the captain was just the captain. And we never hear the name of the old lady or any of the others. Even Christine says, you know, she just refers to the voice in the other room as my uncle.
I don't know. I don't think... all men are all that intuitive, you know, and I think he also probably didn't mind the attention that much, you know, and just never jumped to the conclusion that it would be anything other than conversation.
Well, apparently the hangout closed on us. I guess there must be a time limit. That's good to know. Well, so
Dr. Zhivago is in 65.
Mm-hmm. So that was a year
we
before.
Came and Mrs. Miller, that's funny, 71. I hated it the first time I saw it. And learn to appreciate that.
Well, maybe just a couple of just personal insights here, too. First off, when Bradbury wrote this novel in 1953, he hammered this out on rented typewriters in the basement of the L.A. library at the rate of 10 cents per half hour. Yeah. He said it took him $9.80
awesome.
To do this novel.
Yeah, what I loved was there was somebody asked him about, didn't you have a hard time writing a book about book burning? And he said he was inspired by the fact that all these great books were around him. He said he didn't think he could have written it were he not in a library.
But was it really about book burning?
No, it's not about book burning.
I don't think that was his intention.
That was the direct question.
Yeah.
Right. But no, the actual genesis of he was making a statement about the rise of television and how the mass media was... more or less, in his opinion, destroying the amount of reading that was going on. Now, this was 1953.
Dumbing down the...
This was 1953. TV was just getting started.
Well, but
essentially
you think about,
as a mass medium.
I mean, we just, you know, we saw Good Night and Good Luck, and, I mean, mm-hmm. Murrow was kind of warning about the same thing in terms of the sanitization of news.
Well, the self-filtering, yes. Yeah. The self-censorship because of, we don't want to deal with the unpleasant topic.
Yep. Well, but it was more than that. It was our advertisers don't want mm-hmm. us to deal with the sensitive mm-hmm. topics.
Right. We want you to be happy. We want to keep everybody happy. So, this is a theme that just has been moving through society for some time. And I don't think we're ever going to come to a complete answer for it. Because every new type of communications forum... whether it be TV, radio, online communication, is going to always change the dynamics of the way people communicate. And it's always going to some people, present a threat to the previous generation.
Well, but I even think the threat of the self-medication is kind of interesting as well in terms of the impact on creativity. You know, I just read an article that they're looking at the geographic statistics of medication. And one in six kids is on medicine
something.
For ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the tie into, you know, some of these drugs we're putting ourselves on really, because a lot of the ADHD diagnosis is through, you know, observation. There's no medical test for it, mm-hmm. you know, and what are we doing to creativity?
Well, yeah, you know? Because sometimes some of the greatest creators of civilization has something, quote unquote, wrong with them.
Well, yeah, because they're divergent thinkers. I mean, right. So there is, they are the anomaly. But, you know, if we're anesthetizing them, are we losing out? And you know, and it's,
well, that's just it. At some point, when society loses all its creativity, it starts to die,
mm-hmm.
and you eventually turn into North Korea,
or we start failing as an economy,
or we start failing as a civilization. Period.
Yeah. I mean, take innovation out. We're not going to win wars. We're not going to have an economy.
You're not going to move forward.
Yeah.
You're not going to have any dreams, or if there's no dreamers.
Yeah.
Of course, we don't want people to dream. That's just a waste of time.
Yeah.
You can be more productive doing something else.
So it is kind of spooky when you start thinking about, you know, looking at this movie and how much of it's come true.
Mm-hmm. Or how much of it has come true.
Yeah.
Ray Bradbury said that he got the inspiration for this when he was walking down the street and watched this one person who was walking their dog with a transistor radio they were listening to. And that was the inspiration right there, is, okay, they're not paying attention to anything around them. They're focused on their radio program. Now, how many people around do you see jogging, walking around with their iPod, phones in their head?
Linda in bed, putting in her earbuds. Yes. You know? I was like, I get that one.
Yep.
Boy,
all they needed was texting, and it would have been perfect.
They nailed flat panel TVs. Too.
Oh my God, yes. Did they ever?
When that TV was there, it was like that.
Hey, that's my Samsung.
Yeah, that is forward thinking right there. That was what was funny though is when they bust it, and you can tell it's physically built back into the wall. So that wasn't a flat panel, but just the idea that it was that aesthetic was really cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and they wanted a second one too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they have one in every room, right?
One in every room. Yeah, you had to have one in every room because, God forbid, if you walk away from it and turn your back on your God, you would not see the holy information.
It's interesting that I was kind of thinking about this earlier. Some of the other movies that I had seen, and movies and stories and stuff, that carries on that concept of the dangers of free thinking in a society, and then somebody busting through that. Things like The NeverEnding Story kind of has that. It's a similar type of concept with that character going through that same arc of not having creativity and the lack of creativity, how it's killing the world around them. In NeverEnding Story, it was literally killing the world around them.
Yes, the nothing.
The nothing, yeah. A movie like Pleasantville, where they did it, and I think that has even more similarities, but they went for the visual element of the world is in black and white, and that's the way we like it.
Well, and there's also
the ultimate one, The Truman Show.
Yeah,
ultimate reality show.
Yeah, and their story, like their kids' stories, like The Giver by Lois Lowry, is all about a utopia where everything's the same. Mm-hmm. And like when you turn a certain age, you have to have your hair in a certain way, or that's when you get your bicycle, and it goes all the way through. And mm-hmm. the kid who's supposed to be the next giver, like, no, this isn't working, and runs away. I mean, so there are other novels.
Well, yeah, there's a bunch of. I mean, it's interesting how many creative people fear the lack of creativity around them.
Well, for good reason. I mean, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll bring up another horror movie if you can find it. It's actually based on a short story by Harlan Ellison. It's called A Boy and His Dog.
Mm.
If you can find that movie, it's a pretty cheesy one.
That was Don Johnson, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. The first Don Johnson's first movie. If you can find it and watch it, it's kind of disturbing in spots, but worthwhile. It kind of dovetails into this sort of thing.
Hmm. Well, I don't have a whole lot else.
1975?
Yeah.
It's on Netflix.
Oh, it is on Netflix.
It is.
Is it in Insecure?
It is.
Oh, wow. Well, take a few minutes and watch this rather hoary movie, but it's worthwhile. It's acting's kind of bleh, and the story is...
It is John Johnson.
Yeah, I know, but if you can, go read the Harlan Ellison short story. It's much better. Actually, there is even a sequel to it.
in writing, in written form.
In the written form, not in the movie, thank God.
Okay, let's be done.
All right.
Good. All right, next week we're doing Dog Day Afternoon. So if there, you know what, if there are other summer movies that you guys think of that you think might be interesting for us to talk about, summer's going to last a while, and there's no reason.
September.
There's no reason for us not to talk about summer movies as long as we want, because I think we can let this one drag a little longer than just four or five, just because the topics aren't so closely related that
I don't see us getting
burned out on it.
We're not limiting to genres. Anything that just has sort of a summer element or heat element to it.
Well, or even something that brings up memories. I mean, that was, you know, when I looked at Jaws, I remember going to the drive-in with my dad when he would babysit us and my mom would be working, and, you know, we saw a ton of movies. Yeah, that was one of them. Survivor was another one I remember. Star Wars was a summer movie for me. And, you know, so there's a lot that don't really have a summer theme to them. It just is about summer.
Right, right.
Yeah, I have a collection of short stories by an author whose name just is escaping me at the moment. But in one of the forewords was his mother worked a double shift, so she would take them down to the movie theater and park them there, since it was cheap. You know, it was a dime and whatnot
for
the movies in the 40s and 50s. So she parked them there during the double shift. So he said, I watched every movie from 1947 to 1958. Everything that came through. He says, Detectives, French New Wave, you name it, I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite a movie critic. In fact, he had...
That sounds awesome.
Oh, it was. Think about it for a second. As a kid, you're growing from 10 years old to the time you're about 18. You see every movie just about ever made.
Well, what's cool is, like, my grandmother tells how when they used to go to the movies, she's like, there was no this start time stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They just looped the movie.
Right.
You just walked in. Whatever point you saw the movie, you stayed until you watched the end, and then you watched.
It'd be a few minutes.
That would be horrible.
A few minutes as they looped.
What's interesting, though, is I ran across an advertisement for Psycho, and it said, like, very clearly stated, no one will be admitted to the theater after the first 10 minutes of the movie or something.
Good.
Because they were making somebody at some point along the line realize this movie will be broken for people if you watch it that way. And she's like, oh yeah, that was no big deal for us. We did that all the time.
Yeah, that would drive me crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't do that.
Yeah, one of those days when you could walk in, instead of getting a ton of trailers, you would get like four cartoons, a few advertisements. Let's go to the lobby, and then we start a feature presentation. Yeah. Or we'd have the B picture first, and then the A picture.
Let's see, we used to watch multiple at the drive-in, and my dad would put a big chair up on top of the roof of our van, so we couldn't get down, and my dad would sleep in the car while we were watching. We'd have a big, you know, brown paper bag full of popcorn.
Greasy old buttery popcorn.
We've done that. Watch multiple movies.
We've done that at the drive-in.
That's on our summer bucket list this year.
It's fun. They do it good. They do it really well. You need to make sure you have a good radio in your car, because they do it all through radio now. They don't have the little speaker box anymore.
Yep.
But it's nice because...
It's a much better sound.
You get a
and
much better sound.
Plus, you don't drive off with it.
But you need to make sure you bring a radio, because unless you want to run your car
the whole time...
So that was a mistake we learned about. But yeah, they let you bring in food. They've got concession there. But yeah, we brought a big old.
Well, it's it's part of the experience.
I think we brought like a meal and a snacks.
Yeah.
Well, you're there 4 hours, so at least
might as well make a dinner and a movie.
Yep, exactly.
Dinner and the movie.
Yeah, the first time I saw Star Wars was at a drive-in.
That's
wow.
Me too. Yep. Then proceeded to see it multiple times.
Yeah.
In the summer. And it was like. That was like the big deal, because that was, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, and so to see that movie and choose to pay to see it again and again was a big deal.
That was either sights inside the stuffy old hot house, or go to the drive-in, sit on the open, and eat greasy popcorn and watch a movie.
Yep.
Awesome.
All right. So next week, Dog Day Afternoon. See you then.
Bye-bye.